This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Missions, joining the Space Patrol, winning a gold medal at the Olympics, climbing Mount Everest alone in my bathing suit, sustained only by my indomitable will and strange psychic arts learned from Hindu mystics. The saddest words of tongue or pen are something or other, are what might have been, I think. I light up a cigar and settle down to write another chapter of the Warlord of Saturn's Moons. A filthy habit, you say? Though I'm not sure if you're referring to smoking cigars or writing science fiction. True, I reply. But both activities are pleasurable, and we maiden ladies lead lives that are notoriously short on pleasure. So back I go to the domes of Titan, and my red-headed heroine death-raying down the warlord's minions. The smell of burning flesh, the spectacle of blackened bodies collapsing. Even on paper, it gets a lot of hostility out of you, so that your nights aren't troubled by dreams of murder. Terribly unrestful, those midnight slaughters, and waking, shaking in the darkness, your hands still feeling pressure from grabbing the victim or fighting off the murderer. Another escape! In a power sledge, my heroine races across Titan's methane snow, and I go and make myself tea.
You are entering a zone of sound and imagery. A landscape of frequency. Vocabulary of modulation. There is the signpost up ahead. Please adjust your chronometers. This is Gremlin Time.
Welcome to Gremlin Time. This is Fortunato. We have Professor Kitty with us once again. Hi.
Hello, Fortunato.
Hey. Today we're going to present a couple of science fiction stories. And the first one is by Eleanor Arneson?
Correct.
We'll just get right into it right now. This is a story called The Warlord of Saturn's Moons.
There's a paper on the kitchen table, waiting to tell me all about yesterday's arsons, rapes, and bloody murders. Quickly, I stuff it into the garbage pail. Outside, the sky is hazy. Another high pollution day, I think. I can see incinerator smoke rising from the apartment buildings across the street, which means there's no air alert yet. Unless, of course, they're breaking the law over there. I fling open a cabinet and survey the array of teas. Earl Grey, I ponder. Assam, gunpowder, jasmine, genmai ka, or possibly an herb tea. Sassafras, mint, Irish moss, or moo. Deciding on Assam, I put the water on, then go back to write an exciting chase through the icy Titanian mountains. The pursuer's sledge goes over a precipice, and as my heroine hears this long shriek on her radio, my tea kettle starts shrieking. I hurry into the kitchen. Now I go through the tea-making ceremony, pouring boiling water into the pot, sloshing the water around and pouring it out, measuring the tea in, pouring more boiling water on top of the tea. All the while, my mind is with my heroine, smiling grimly as she pilots the power sledge between bare cliffs. Above her in the dark sky is the huge crescent of Saturn, a shining white line slashing across it, the famous rings. While the tea steeps, I wipe off a counter and wash a couple of mugs. I resist a sudden impulse to pull the newspaper out from among the used tea leaves and orange peelings. I already know what's in it. The Detroit murder count will exceed 1,000 again this year. The war in Thailand is going strong. Most of Europe is out on strike. I'm far better off on Titan with my heroine, who is better able to deal with her problems than I am to deal with mine. A deadly shot. She has also learned strange psychic arts from Hindu mystics, which give her great strength, endurance, mental alertness, and a naturally pleasant body odor. I wipe my hands and look at them. noticing the bitten fingernails, the torn cuticles. My heroine's long, slender, strong hands have 2-inch nails filed to a point and covered with a plastic paint that makes them virtually unbreakable. When necessary, she uses them as claws. Her cuticles, of course, are in perfect condition. I pour myself a cup of tea and return to the story. Now my heroine is heading for the mountain hideout where her partner waits. A tall, thin, dour fellow with one shining steel prosthetic hand. She doesn't know his name, and she suspects he himself may have forgotten it. He insists on being called 409, his number on the prison asteroid from which he has escaped. She drives as quickly as she dares, thinking of his long face, burned almost black by years of strong radiation on Mars and in space, so the white webbing of scars on its right side shows up clearly. His eyes are gray, so pale they seem almost colorless. As I write about 409, I find myself stirred by the same passion that stirs my heroine. I begin to feel uneasy, so I stop and drink some tea. I can see I'm going to have trouble with 409. It's never wise to get too involved with one's characters. Besides, I'm not his type. I imagine the way he'd look at me, indifference evident on his dark, scarred face. I could, of course, kill him off. My heroine would then spend the rest of the story avenging him, though she'd never get to the real murderer, me. But this solution, while popular among writers, is unfair. I go into the kitchen, extract a carrot from a bunch in the icebox, clean it, and eat it. After that, I write the heroine's reunion with 409. Neither of them is demonstrative. They greet each other with apparent indifference and retire to bed. I skip the next scene. How can I watch that red-headed hussy in bed with the man I'm beginning to love? I continue the story at the moment when the alarm bell rings and they awake to find the warlord's rocket planes have landed all around their hideout. A desperate situation. 409 suggests that he make a run for it in their rocket plane. While the warlord's minions pursue him, my heroine can sneak away in the power sledge. The plan has little chance of success, but they can think of none better. They bid farewell to one another, and my heroine goes to wait in the sledge for the signal telling her 409 has taken off. As she waits, smoking a cigar, she thinks of what little she knows about 409. He was a fighter pilot in the war against the Martian colony and was shot down and captured. While in prison, something happened to him that he either can't remember or refuses to talk about. And when the war ended and he was released, he became a criminal. As for herself, she had been an ordinary sharpshooter and a student of Hindu mysticism, a follower of Swami Bluestone of the Brooklyn Vedic Temple and Rifle Range. Then she discovered by accident the warlord's plot to overthrow the government of Titan, the only one of Saturn's satellites not under his control. With her information about the plot, the government may still be saved. She has to get to Titan City with the microfilm dot. The alarm bell rings, and she feels the ground shake as 409's plane takes off. Unfortunately, I'm writing the story from my heroine's point of view. I want to describe 409 blasting off, the warlord's rockets, planes taking off after him, chasing him as he flies through the narrow, twisting valleys, the plane's rockets flaring red in the valley shadows, and missiles exploding into yellow fireballs. All through this, of course, 409's scarred face remains tranquil, and his hands move quickly and surely over the plane's controls. His steel prosthetic hand gleams in the dim light from the dials. But I can't put this in the story, since my heroine sees none of it, as she slides off in the opposite direction, down a narrow trail hidden by overhanging cliffs. I am beginning to feel tense. I don't know why. Possibly 409's dilemma is disturbing me. He's certainly in danger. In any case, my tea is cold. I turn on the radio, hoping for some relaxing rock music and go to get more tea. But it's 20 to the hour, time for the news, and I get the weekend body count. 2 men found dead in suspected West Side dope house, naked body of woman dragged out of Detroit River. I hurry back and switch to a country music station. On it, someone's singing about how he intends to leave the big city and go back down south. As I go back into the kitchen, I think, carry me back to Titan. That's where I want to be. I want to repose on the methane snows at the edge of a frozen sea. I pour out the old tea and refill the cup with tea that's hot. The radio begins to make that awful beepity-beep, beepity-beep sound that warns you the news is coming up. I switch back to the rock station, where the news is now over. I'm safe for another 55 minutes, unless there's a special news flash to announce a five-car pileup or an especially ghastly murder. The plan works. For my heroine, at least. She doesn't know yet if 409 got away. She speeds off unpursued. The power sludge's heating system doesn't quite keep her warm, and the landscape around her is forbidding. Bare cliffs and narrow valleys full of methane snow. Overhead, the dark blue sky. Saturn has set, and the tiny sun is rising, though she can't see it yet. On the high mountains, the ice fields begin to glitter with its light. On she races, remembering how she met 409 in the slums of the Cup on Ganymede as she fled the warlord's assassins. She remembers being cornered with no hope of escape. Then, behind the two assassins, a tall figure appeared and the shining steel hand smashed down on the back of one assassin's head. As the other assassin turned, he got the hand across his face. A moment or two more and both the assassins were on the ground unconscious. Then she saw 409's twisted grin for the first time and his colorless eyes appraising her. There I go, I think. Getting all heated up over 409. The radio is beginning to bother me, so I shut it off and relight my cigar. I find myself wishing that men like 409 really existed. Increasingly, in recent years, I found real men boring. Is it possible, as some scientists argue, that the Y chromosome produces an inferior human being? There certainly seem to be far fewer interesting men than interesting women. But theories arguing that one kind of human being is naturally inferior make me anxious. I feel my throat muscles tightening and the familiar, tense, numb feeling spreading across my face and my upper back. Quickly, I return to my story. Now, out on the snowy plain, my heroine can see the transparent domes of Titan City ahead of her, shining in the pale sunlight. Inside the domes, the famous pastel towers rise, their windows reflecting the sun. The power sledge speeds down the road, through the drifts that half cover it. Snow sprays up on either side of the sledge, so my heroine has trouble seeing to the left and right. As a result, it's some time before she sees the power sledges coming up behind her on the right. At the same moment that she looks over and sees them, their sleek silver bodies shining in the sunlight and snow spray shooting up around them, her radio begins to go beep, beep, beep. She flicks it on. The voice of Janos Black, the warlord's chief agent on Titan, harsh and slurred by a thick Martian accent, tells her the bad news. 409's plane has been shot down. He ejected before it crashed. Even now, the warlord's men are going after the ejection capsule, which is high on a cliff, wedged behind a rock spire and the cliff wall. Janos offers her a trade. 409 for the microdot. But Janos may well be lying. 409 may have gotten away or else been blown up. She feels a sudden constriction of her throat at the thought of 409 dead. She flicks off the radio and pushes the power sledge up to top speed. She realizes as she does so that 409 is unlikely to fare well if Janos gets a hold of him. Janos' wife and children died of thirst after the great Martian network of pipelines was blown apart by Earth bombs, and Janos knows that 409 was a pilot in the Earther Expeditionary Force. I write another exciting chase, this one across the snowy plain, toward the pink, green, blue, and yellow towers of Titan City. The warlord's power sledges are gaining. Their rockets hit all around my heroine's sledge, and fire and black smoke erupt out of the snow. Swearing in a low monotone, she swings the sledge back and forth in a zigzag, evasive pattern. I stop to puff on my cigar and discover it's gone out again. My tea is cold, but the story's beginning at last to interest me. I keep on writing. As my heroine approaches the entrance to Titan City, she's still a short distance ahead of her pursuers. Her radio beeps. It's Janice Black again. He tells her his men have gotten to the ejection capsule and are lowering it down the cliff. Any minute now, they'll have it downed where they can open it and get 409 out. Ignoring Janos, she concentrates on slowing her sledge and bringing it through the city's outer gate into the airlock. A moment or two later, she's safe. But what about 409? Frankly, I don't know. I stand and stretch, decide to take a bath, and go to turn the water on. The air pollution must be worse than I originally thought. I have the dopey feeling I get on the days when the pollution is really bad. I look out the window. Dark gray smoke is still coming out of the chimneys across the street. Maybe I should call the air control number. Dial AIRCARE and complain. But it takes a peculiar kind of person to keep on being public-spirited after it becomes obvious it's futile. I decide to put off calling air control and water my plants instead. Every bit of oxygen helps, I think. I check the bathtub. It's not yet half full. And go back to writing. After a couple of transitional paragraphs, my heroine finds herself in the antechamber to the Titans Council's meeting room. There's a man there, standing with his back to her. He's tall and slender, and his long hair is a shade between blonde and gray. He turns, and she recognizes the pale, delicate-looking face. This is Michael Stelladoro, the warlord of Saturn's moons. His eyes, she notices, are as blue as cornflowers, and he has a delightful smile. He congratulates her on escaping his power sledges, then tells her that his men have gotten 409 out of the ejection capsule. He is still alive, and as far as they can determine, uninjured. They have given 409 a shot of sofamine. At this, my heroine gasps with horror. Sofamine, she knows, is an extremely powerful tranquilizer used to control schizophrenia. One dose is enough to make most people dependent on it, and withdrawal takes the form of a nightmarish psychotic fugue. The warlord smiles his delightful smile and turns on the radio he has clipped to his belt. A moment later, my heroine hears 409's voice telling her that he has in fact been captured. He sounds calm and completely uninterested in the situation. That, she knows, is the sofamine. It hasn't affected his perception of reality. He knows where he is and what is likely to happen to him, but he simply doesn't care. When the sofamine wears off, all the suppressed emotions will well up, so intense that the only way he'll be able to deal with him will be to go insane. Temporarily, at least. The warlord tells her he regrets having to use the sofamine, but he was certain that 409 would refuse to talk unless he was either drugged or tortured, and there simply wasn't enough time to torture him. "You fiend!" my heroine cries. The warlord smiles again, as delightfully as before, and says if she gives the microdot to the Titan Council, he will turn 409 over to Janos Black, who will attempt to avenge on him all the atrocities committed by the Earthers on Mars. What can she do? As she wonders, the door to the meeting room opens, and she is asked to come in. For a moment, she thinks of asking the Titanians to arrest the warlord. Almost as if he's read her mind, he tells her there's no point in asking the Titanians to arrest him. He has diplomatic immunity and a war fleet waiting for him to return. She turns to go into the meeting room. "I'll tell Janos the good news," the warlord says softly and turns his radio on. She hesitates, then thinks, "A man this evil must be stopped, no matter what the cost." She goes into the meeting room. I remember the bathwater. Leap up and run into the bathroom. The tub is brim full and about to overflow. I turn off the tap, let out some of the water, and start to undress. After I climb into the tub, I wonder how I'm going to get 409 out of the mess he's in. Something will occur to me. I grab the bar of soap floating past my right knee. After bathing, I put on a pink and silver muumuu and make a fresh pot of tea. Cleanliness is next to godliness, I think, as I sit down to write. My heroine tells her story to the Titan Council and produces the microdot. On it is the warlord's plan for taking over the government of Titan and a list of all the Titanian officials he has subverted. The president of the council thanks her kindly and tells her that they already have a copy of the microdot, obtained for them by an agent of theirs who has infiltrated the warlord's organization. "Oh no," my heroine cries. Startled, the president asks her what's wrong. She explains that she has sacrificed her partner, her love, to bring them information they already had. "Rest easy," the president says. "Our agent is none other than Janos Black. He won't harm 409. Thinking of Janos's family dying of thirst in an isolated settlement, my heroine feels none too sure of this. But there's nothing left for her to do except hope. After that, I describe her waiting in Titan City for news, wandering restlessly through the famous gardens, barely noticing the beds of Martian sandflowers, the blossoming magnolia trees, the ponds of enormous silver carp. Since the warlord now knows that the Titan Council knows about his schemes, the council moves quickly to answer the officials he subverted. The newscasts are full of scandalous revelations, and the warlord leaves Titan for his home base, another one of Saturn's moons. My heroine pays no attention to the newscasts or to the excited conversations going on all around her. She thinks of the trip she and 409 made from Ganymede to Titan in a stolen moonhopper, remembering 409's hands on the ship's controls, the way he moved in zero-G, his colorless eyes, and his infrequent, twisted smile. Cornball, I think, but leave the passage in. I enjoy thinking about 409 as much as my heroine does. After 2 days, Janos Black arrives in a police plane. 409 is with him. Janos comes to see my heroine to bring her the news of their arrival. He's a tall man with a broad chest and spindly arms and legs. His face is ruddy and Slavic, and his hair is prematurely white. He tells her that he has kept 409 prisoner in the warlord's secret headquarters in the Titanian mountains till the Titanian police moved in and arrested everybody. "Then he's all right," she cries joyfully. Janos shakes his head. "Why not?" "The sulfamine," Janos explains. "When it wore off, he got hit with the full force of all his repressed feelings. Especially, I think, the feelings he had about the war on Mars. Think of all that anger and terror and horror and guilt flooding into his conscious mind. He tried to kill himself. We stopped him. And he almost killed a couple of us in the process. By we, I mean myself and the warlord's men. This happened before the police moved in. We had to give him another shot of sulfamine. He's still full of the stuff. From what I've heard, the doctors want to keep giving it to him. They think the first shot of sulfamine he got destroyed his old system of dealing with his more dangerous emotions, which are now overwhelming him. The doctors say on sulfamine he can function more or less normally. Off it, they think he'll be permanently insane." "You planned this," she cries. Janos shakes his head. "The warlord gave the order, miss. I only obeyed it. But I didn't mind this time. I didn't mind." I stop to drink some tea. Then I write the final scene in the chapter. My heroine's meeting with 409. He's waiting for her in a room at the Titan City Hospital. The room is dark. He sits by the window, looking out at the tall towers, blazing with light, and at the dome above them, which reflects the tower's light, so it's impossible to look through it at the sky. She can see his dark shape and the red tip of the cigar he smokes. "Do you mind if I turn on the lights?" she asks. "No." She finds the button and presses it. The ceiling begins to glow. She looks at 409. He lounges in his chair, his feet up on a table. She realizes it's the first time she's seen him look really relaxed. Before this, he always seemed tense, even when asleep. "How are you?" she asks. Fine. His voice sounds tranquil and indifferent. She can't think of anything to say. He looks at her, his dark, scarred face expressionless. Finally, he says, "Don't let it bother you. I feel fine." He pauses. She still can't think of anything to say. He continues, "The pigs don't want me for anything here on Titan. I think I'll be able to stay." "What are you going to do here?" "Work, I guess. The doctors say I can hold down a job if I keep taking sulfamine." He draws on the cigar, so the tip glows red, then blows out the smoke. He keeps looking away from her at the towers outside the window. She begins weeping. He looks back at her. "I'm all right. Believe me, I feel fine." But she can't stop weeping. Enough for today, I think, and put the cover back on my typewriter. Tomorrow, I'll figure out a way to get 409 off sulfamine. Where there's life, there's hope, and so forth, I tell myself.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. This is Gremlin Time. You've just heard The Warlord of Saturn's Moons, a short story by Eleanor Arneson from 1974. I believe she was nominated for a Nebula Award for that story. She's also got a number of novels out, Ring of Swords, A Woman of the Iron People, and different sorts of short stories. So you can look her up on the internet. And we'll be back after this.
Starry eyes. We'd take the path to Jupiter, and maybe very soon we'd cruise along the Milky Way and land upon the moon. To a wonderland of stardust, we'll zoom our way to Mars. My heart would be a fireball, a fireball, 'cause you
Hi, this is Peter Bergman, Fire Sign Theater. You know, we've been together since 1966. Started out on Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. It was free radio. Well, the only real free radio station left with a sense of humor and a sense of place where it's easy for the Fire Sign Theater to feel at home, which we do, is KBOO. And I tell you, as far as I'm concerned, KBOO is the radio home of the Fire Sign Theater. 90.7 in Portland. Too many bridges.
January 18, 2013. KBOO Navigator Report. Overwhelming support and a record number of donations were received at the close of 2012. Thank you, KBOO donors. 6 months of hard work have resulted in a more knowledgeable board and updated board policies, completing a grant from the Meyer Memorial Trust. A new partnership with mainstreamed media will give reporters with developmental disabilities a voice on the KBOO Evening News. The KBOO Council of Elders will be gathering in March. For more information, contact Lynn Fitch, 503-231-8032, extension 222, or navigator at kboo.org. This has been the Weekly Navigator Report. Thank you.
And now back to Gremlin Time. Our next story was written by Gene Wolfe and is entitled Useful Phrases. Part 1. Show me something better. I found the phrase book in my pocket. That itself seems to me extraordinary and significant, for I have a great many books, both at home. To confess the truth, my small apartment is furnished with little else, and in my bookshop. I need not, I hope, describe my shop to you, who have been in it so often. There are a great many used books there, as you know, a few new ones, and a small rack for magazines. There is a cat asleep in the window. Her name is La Fionda Linda. There is the plants, the cash register, and me. Mine is the last bookshop in the city and has been for many years to wrap packages in brown paper and tie the package with string. I have some customers who give me their trade for that reason alone. I frequently buy entire grocery boxes of books when they can be bought cheaply enough without examining their contents very thoroughly. After all, if I can get the whole box full for $3, and I've seen two books that should bring five or more, why shouldn't I? When I have more time, I go through the box with care. Put the junk into the 25-cent bin I set out on the sidewalk on fine days, and alas, take home a book or three that I imagine may someday I wish to read myself. No doubt the phrase book reached my pocket by that route, though I have no memory of having put it there. On a day in late winter or early spring, I must have purchased such a box. I wonder what else was in it. From somebody who was moving. I think I can guess now where he was going. It must have intrigued me, even though not so much that I remembered it when I reached home. At the tail end of October, when the first ice storm swept in from the plains, I wore my winter coat again and discovered it. It is small and by no means thick, with a handsome blue cover I take to be simulated leather. The odd script on this cover means, as I now know, no more than useful phrases. Tohish Ablar. The full title from the title page is Toblish Ablar Sens Oriya Ert. That is to say, useful phrases for piteous visitors to Earth. I'm guessing at the final word, which does not occur elsewhere, but this identification seems to be very probable. At first, I could not make heads nor tails of the writing, of course. But opposite each phrase in the book of Tekove, the book supplies both a phonetic translation, like in the 53 characters of the Diloveta, naturally, and a plain written version in the telestial language involved, Tim of Molar, for example, which is Show Me Something Better in Portuguese. I concentrated on the English and French at first for obvious reasons, and they provided me with the pronunciation of the characters of the Diloveta, six of which are pronounced alike as P, but one of which is pronounced in five different ways, K, Q, Cha, Chi, in German, Icht, X, and VK, Vec, depending upon its position in the word and the word's position in the sentence. As was only to be expected, I supposed then that the language was a merely terrestrial one with which I was unfamiliar. Even so, many of the phrases thus translated struck me as peculiar. Who would wish to say, you no longer recognize her? Mine is a similar address, or I will tell the trees to be quiet. I studied all these phrases diligently, however, so much so that I sometimes found myself murmuring in my bath, Pavapatish utra nevsod divjati. How like a ghost are the fountain's waters. The flood carries away my riches. The paper is marvelously thin and yet completely opaque. The print sharp-edged even when viewed through my best magnifying glass. All this time, I should explain, I was fairly itching to put my book plate in the book and index it as a permanent part of my library, neither of which I felt that I could properly do until I learned the location, Tokve, the linguistic group or groups to which its tongue belonged, and something of its history. I consulted atlases and encyclopedias and found all equally unhelpful. Tovgve, I decided, was surely one of those nations, like Deutschland and Hellas, which we call by quite different names. Still, I persisted in my determination. Apenpenis, Tiliat, Sicum praetilis et somme matra, I shall know the names of the angels on the peaks of my homeland. Part 2. The Three Visitors. A year or more passed while I studied and planned, though only for my own amusement at first, the advertisement I eventually ran. Should I offer a reward? It could not be a very large one. $100, perhaps, or 5 free books? Should I include no more than my telephone number? And if so, should it be the number of the store or that of my apartment? And what about a coded box at the newspaper, such as the one sees in the personals? In the end, I settled for the wording I give here. Hesitant speaker of Tokvasi would welcome acquaintance of native speakers and discussion of language and culture. Precious Pages Bookstore, 444 1/2 North Washington. I was greatly tempted to write the ad itself in Tokvasi, as you may imagine, but it would have lost half its force, or so I felt, in the Roman alphabet, and would almost certainly have been disfigured by the printer. My first visitor arrived on the first day my ad ran. He showed me a badge and asked to speak with me in private. I took him into the little back room I call my office. He asked how I had found out about Tokvasi, and I asked whether he spoke it. Just a little, he said, a few words. I confess that it was the same with me. Nadja Porvere. You could be useful to the department, he told me. We could pay you a little something, not much. The fixed stare of his narrowed eyes told me he was lying. I wished that I'd had a better look at the badge he'd showed me. He pursed his lips.
Once say 25 ahead, 50 if we need you to ask them questions.
I indicated that additional income was always welcome and asked what he wished me to do. He gave me a business card. I have it still. It identifies him as Detective Lieutenant James R. Ropinski. The address is that of the 18th Precinct, but the telephone number is not theirs.
First off, I want you to call me anytime somebody comes in about that ad. Give me a name and a description, and tell me everything he said. Try to get an address and so on. Any hard information you can. The mob's been bringing in hitmen from Tokve. We need to know about every one of those guys.
I nodded, although I had already decided that I would not cooperate. Am I the first one? I asked what he meant.
The first one that's answered your ad.
I assured him he was, and asked what Tokvees looked like, in order that I might recognize them. I had visualized small Orientals.
Pretty much like you, he said, or like me, regular people.
I addressed him and took the ease, employing one of the phrases from the book. Ritop imbrassoniere min mios constesi sus. Are you familiar with these lovely caverns? He stared at me and shook his head. When he left, I looked up the number of the 18th precinct in the telephone directory, called and asked for him. I was told, as I expected to be, that there was no one of that name. My second visitor arrived almost a year to the day after my advertisement had appeared, long after I had surrendered hope of any further response. He was a very tall black man, exceedingly well-dressed.
I come for what you have said here.
He extracted my advertisement, much folded and refolded and soiled, from an elegant ostrich hide wallet.
I am Consul Tokvi. You hear? Not here in the city, another city. For me, long trip. You hear?
His hand shook as he held out the torn scrap of paper. I addressed to him the phrase I had so often rehearsed. Simaphonicisi sima texodilophile dera infionda linda tukyas siascul chrysalione. How delightful to discover in the shrinking sea a crystal blossom of home. He dropped my advertisement and ran from the shop. My third visitor arrived only last night. It is due to that visitation, if I may employ so pretentious a word,
that I am writing this account for you. The day had been dark, as winter days here so often are. At 6, and I inspected the cat's food and water bowls and locked the front door of the shop and pulled down the blind. The street lights were on. The thought of my cold, empty apartment with its waiting stacks and boxes of books held no attractions. I lit the gas ring in my office instead and filled the kettle. Then, settling into my old wooden swivel chair, I mused upon the possibility of night hours. What if I were to close each day at 2, nap, and reopen at night, remaining open till midnight? Might I not soon discover that I had acquired a new clientele, or however it pronounced, might I not increase my income sufficiently to afford a vacation? I wanted very badly to go somewhere, though I didn't know where. After a moment or two, I rebuked myself for wasting my time when I might, if I had gone to my apartment, be studying Tohish Ablar. Then remembered that it was in the pocket of my overcoat and got it out. And Sushis Mimblar Sisert Va, where my strangers erect their pavilions. Nimit Mira Ori Sus, you will be my wife while I am here. Afutel to going blute, I hunger for taller trees. I dozed, and it seemed to me that I was walking beside a little rippling stream whose water was so pure as to be almost invisible, and so cold that flecks of ice tumbled in its current, flashing in the sunshine. Minute fish with wide wings of polychrome gauze that were in fact their pectoral fins leaped from the freezing water to catch flying seeds that seemed to know and fear them, darting this way and that like tiny green helicopters, and plunged back into the stream to breathe. The trees to either side of the stream, no doubt they were inspired by that last phrase I had read, were 15 feet or more through the trunk and seemed almost to touch the sky. Springs gushed from about their roots, bordered by flowers that turned their blossoms toward me as I walked, as though eager to be seen. Each was like the beautiful face of a young woman. I don't mean that they had eyes, noses, and so forth, but that they evoked the same response in me. I knelt, discovering that I was holding a small knife with a crooked blade, and I awoke. The shop was dark, silent, except for the hissing of my gas ring and the bubbling of the kettle. And yet, I knew that I was not alone, that someone had entered while I slept, turned off the lights, and remained waiting. I got up and went out into the public part of the shop.
Before now.
Remember me, a soft voice, vibrating and haunting. No, no, I said, I don't even know who you are. I forgive you. Who are you? I shouted. What are you? Where are you? Why can't you forgive yourself, please? By that time, I had reached the light switch. I shouted something more. I do not remember what I said, and turned on the lights. I was alone, still old, still dressed in my old tweed jacket, which badly needed cleaning, as I do, I suppose. Nothing had changed, as do I suppose. Nothing had changed. My cat, Crystal Flower Maiden, trotted busily about the shop, peering behind each freestanding bookcase, obviously looking for someone who was no longer present. When I returned to my little office to take the kettle off the gas ring, I found that someone had already brewed a cup of tea for me, and that there, floating in it briefly, a tiny pink and white blossom like those in my dream. As I watched it melting, filling the dusty little room with an indescribable fragrance, which vanish too in half a minute or less. Part 3. The Hidden Page. It was very late before I could bring myself to leave the shop and walk the 5 blocks that separated me from my apartment. Perhaps I should not have included this, but I was mugged, knocked down from behind by someone I never saw, who took my money and my watch and searched me frantically while I lay sprawled on the sidewalk for something that he never found. I remember that he searched my left coat pocket twice, tearing it away to make certain it was empty. Dazed and bleeding, I reached my building at last, locked and bolted the door of my second floor apartment, for I was very much afraid my assailant had followed me, though I know how irrational that sounds. Stripped and showered, contrived a clumsy bandage for the wound on the back of my head, which was still oozing blood, poured myself 4 fingers of scotch, and took the phrase book from my ruined coat's remaining pocket. I could not explain how it came to be, but I felt now that I could paste my bookplate in it and index it too, acts that I had longed to perform ever since I rediscovered it. I had advertised for speakers, but found no speaker more fluent than myself. I had walked through a forest of Tokov, if only in dreams, why not? Bookplates are, as you are doubtless aware, properly attached to the inner surface of the front board, or at slightly below its center. Mine I designed myself, and had printed at a little shop not far from my own. Thus, they are not gummed, as the commercial products are, and I am compelled to spread the back of each with thin mucilage before I attach it. Then I close the book in question and put it under several others, usually until morning. On this final occasion, I did not wait so long. As I was preparing for bed, I realized that I had forgotten, though I had once known, the Tokvi'i's word for love. And a few minutes ago, unable to sleep, I surrendered to the impulse and got the Tohi Shablar from beneath its little stack of odd volumes. A half drop of mucilage had escaped from beneath my bookplate and so gummed what I had believed to be the back of the front board to the flyleaf. When I opened the book, the false back was thus pulled away, revealing a black endpaper upon which someone had written in silver ink a name that is not mine in the characters of the Diloveta. Thus, I write to you now as I do, for I feel that I will not be with you much longer. Twice the telephone has rung. On the first occasion, I answered it with hello, as I usually do, and the caller hung up. On the second, but I will not tell you that. Again and again, I find myself drawn to the window. Clouds, gravit with snow, hung low over the city, hiding every star but one. I will finish this before morning, take it to my shop and place it in an old book, or a new one, or perhaps in one of the magazines upon my little rack. There you have found it. And I hope, have gone. May your torment too soon be ended. At noon. She said, at noon. I will leave the book behind for you as well, my unknown reader and customer. You may know it by my bookplate. Deja here now.
You've been listening to Useful Phrases, a short story by Gene Wolfe, who is the author of Death of Dr. Island, The Shadow of the Torturer, Soldier of the Mist, multiple award winner, Locus Award, Nebula Award, World Fantasy Award, has a lot of books out there worth picking up. Well, this has been Gremlin Time with Fortunato. We've got some time here to play some music. It's kind of keeping this future-y, science fiction-y vein here as we stay tuned for the Tiki Cha-Cha Club. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back again next month.
on the Bedtime Radio Show for grown-ups.
Secret agent man. Secret agent man. They give me. The theme from the Green Hornet, Al Hurt back there. We had Out of Limits, or the Marquettes. Way back there, the theme from Fireball, XL5. And of course, a little classical music from Devo, Secret Agent Man. We're going to get out of here right now with the B-52. Stay tuned for the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, right here on Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Stay tuned for the Tiki Cha-Cha Club.
In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing word and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room,
welcome to our tropical hideaway, you lucky people you. If we weren't in the show starting right away, we'd sing the audience too.
All together in the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing word and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.
Birds of paradise is an elegant bird. It likes to be seen and it loves to be heard. Most little birdies will fly away, but the tiki room birds are here every day.
In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room,
a little
louder. In the tiki 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 room, all the birds sing words and the flowers croon. In the tiki tiki
taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. This is the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, where the cocktail nation meets exotica at the corner of Kalakaua Boulevard and Bourbon Street in a little Spanish village, a small discotheque on the Isle of Capri.
Thank you.